Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, our top stories are out of Lemon Grove, where Councilman Matt Mendoza has resigned. Find out how his vacancy will be filled on today's show. Plus, we have news about a judicial order involving a lawsuit against Lemon Grove and the tally of signatures to qualify a sales tax initiative for the ballot in Lemon Grove in March. On our Capitol Report, hear about threats by President Donald Trump to cut off federal funding for fighting wildfires and helping fire victims in California after he offered help to Russia to fight wildfires in Siberia. Sunny skies are in the forecast for our weather outlook locally, and we'll have details. Then we'll have some health warnings for you today about two product recalls involving frozen berries and chicken parts. On Green Scene, learn more about microgrids, an option being touted to keep the lights on for communities even when power companies shut off power, as major utilities have done across much of California in recent weeks to prevent wildfires. And then on our People Power Report, find out what it's like to work in a flying emergency room in our story on Mercy Air, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary of saving lives locally. Over 80% of California's eligible voters are now registered to vote, and we'll have details today from California News Service. Then on Destination East County, hear about all the festivals and events coming up across our inland region, including the Mother Goose Parade, fall festivals, concerts, plays, pomegranate days at the Oasis Camel Dairy, and the start of Christmas holiday season happenings. Next up on Bookshelf, we'll be re-airing our interview with Donald Harrison, the author of Schlepping Across the American West, There's a Jewish Story Everywhere. Then we'll have some turkey safety tips for you just in time for cooking up your Thanksgiving feast. And we'll have a report from California News Service on an increase in uninsured children in our state. And finally, we'll have a rundown on Veterans Day weekend events, including a warrior hike up El Capitan, family fishing at Lake Jennings, and a ceremony in El Cajon honoring our veterans. We salute all of our military veterans and their families, and we wish all of you a safe and sound holiday weekend. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Lemon Grove Councilman Matt Mendoza has resigned after moving to Florida for his job with Boeing. The City Council has voted to fill that vacancy by appointment. Applications will be accepted from November 11th through November 21st at City Hall. The appointee will serve out the remaining year in Mendoza's term. Mendoza was first elected in 2016 and has drawn praise from his colleagues on both sides of the political aisle for his commitment to the community and fiscal responsibility. His resignation comes just 1 week after Mendoza was ordered by a judge to have his deposition taken as a witness in a lawsuit filed against the city of Lemon Grove and against Councilman David Arambula. The city has fought to prevent Mendoza's deposition from being taken by the plaintiff's attorney, Corey Briggs. The lawsuit, slated for trial in mid-December, alleges that Arambula assaulted Chris Williams, who met with Arambula at the councilman's home regarding cannabis dispensary applications that Williams had pending. Williams was later treated at an emergency room for serious injuries. Arambula has claimed he acted in self-defense. Mendoza, who reportedly spoke with Arambula about the attack, could be a key witness in the case. A judge has also ordered defendants to pay Williams $1,500 in sanctions related to Mendoza failing to appear, so far, for a deposition. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
The Registrar of Voters confirms that a Lemon Grove sales tax measure has qualified to appear on the March 2020 ballot. If approved by voters, the initiative would increase the city's sales tax by 0.75 cents to 8.5%, the same as neighboring La Mesa. The stakes are high for Lemon Grove residents and businesses. Advocates contend that $3 million in projected revenues from the measure are needed since the city faces a $400,000 deficit by the end of next year, which is projected to reach nearly $1.2 million by 2022. Lemon Grove spends over 80% of its current revenues on public safety for sheriff and fire protection, with not enough funds left over for road repairs, parks, recreation programs, or other needs of residents. Supporters of the initiative include the Deputy Sheriff's Association, Heartland Firefighters, and Mayor Raquel Vasquez. Critics argue that the measure could hurt businesses and low-income residents, also making it harder to attract new businesses. Those opposed have called for the city to further cut staff and to consider disincorporation, or asking the county to take back control and end Lemon Grove cityhood. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Gerald Stevenson with East County Magazine's Capitol Report. Days after California Governor Gavin Newsom praised the federal government for its rapid response to catastrophic wildfires and power outages affecting millions of our state's residents, President Donald Trump threatened to cut off all future federal funding to California. On November 3rd, Trump accused Newsom on Twitter of a, quote, terrible job of forest management, unquote. The president claimed California hasn't done enough to clean forest floors and to control burns, adding, every year as the fires rage and California burns, it is the same thing. And then he comes to the federal government for money help. No more. Get your act together, Governor. But in an article titled, Trump Threatens Funding for California Forest Fires That Didn't Happen, the Los Angeles Times pointed out, the big fires that hit Southern California last week burned expensive Los Angeles homes, swept through lush agricultural land, closed the 405 freeway, and threatened a presidential library. But they did not burn through large swaths of forests. Trump's arguments that the state should do more to rake forest floors and do controlled burns on state-controlled lands last year were similarly debunked. In fact, the state has substantially beefed up funding for controlled burns and cleaning dead trees from state forests. The most devastating wildfire last year, the Camp Fire, which killed 84 people in Paradise, California, did not start in a forest. Some other major fires started in federal forests or on private land. Governor Newsom pushed back against Trump's threat to end funding for firefighting and aid for fire victims in California. The governor told Politico, "We're successfully waging war against thousands of fires started across the state in the last few weeks due to extreme weather created by climate change, while Trump is conducting a full-on assault against the antidotes." In a tweet of his own, Newsom responded directly to Trump, stating, "You don't believe in climate change. You're excused from this conversation." The governor's spokesman, Jesse Melgar, pointed up hypocrisy by the president. Melgar told Politico, "The reality is that while California has increased fire prevention investments and fuel management projects, the federal government has slashed its funding of those same activities." Critics contend that the president is using disaster victims as pawns for political retribution against a state that has fought back hard against many Trump policies. No prior president has tied disaster aid to political support. Ironically, Trump's threat to cut off aid to California during wildfires comes just 3 months after he offered aid to Russian President Vladimir Putin to help with Russian wildfires. A statement from the Kremlin in late July acknowledged, "The U.S. president offered Russia cooperation in fighting forest fires in Siberia. President Putin expressed his sincere gratitude for such an attentive attitude and for the offer of help and support," according to Reuters News Service.
This is Rebecca Williamson with a weather report. Sunny skies are forecast over the next several days with some patchy night and early morning fog. High temperatures will be in the high 70s with the lows in the high 50s. Thankfully, the humidity will be around 32%, reducing the fire danger. But there's still no rain on the horizon, so fire weather conditions could return if the humidity falls and Santa Ana winds return.
This is Gerald Stevenson with a health alert. Frozen raspberry products, recalled for possible hepatitis A contamination, were sold in 8 Aldi supermarkets in San Diego County, including the Aldi store on Navajo Road in San Carlos, here in East County. The contaminated berries were also in yogurt parfaits served at cafeterias in the Escondido Union School District, the County Health and Human Services Agency has announced. There have been no illnesses reported due to exposure to these products. A nationwide recall on frozen raspberries sold under the Aldi and Raley's Supermarket private label brands was posted by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration on October 31st due to possible contamination with the hepatitis A virus. The virus was detected in a routine sampling program conducted by the FDA, which led to the voluntary recall. People who have purchased the berries should not eat them and should return them to the store for a refund. The California Department of Public Health has published a full list of locations where the berries were sold or served. County Public Health Officer Dr. Wilma Wooten says anyone who has not had 2 hepatitis A vaccinations and ate the recalled frozen raspberry products or the yogurt parfaits made from them should talk to their health care provider about getting immunizations to prevent the illness. Everyone who ate these items should be aware of the symptoms of hepatitis A and seek medical attention early if they appear. Signs of hepatitis A can appear between 2 and 7 weeks after exposure. Symptoms include mild fever, loss of appetite, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, fatigue, pain in the upper right side of the abdomen, dark urine, and jaundice or yellow eyes or skin. It is important that if you have these symptoms, you seek medical attention and do not work in food service, health care, or child care until you are no longer infectious. The hepatitis A vaccine or immune globulin can prevent infection if given within 14 days of exposure. The vaccine is available from health care providers and at county public health centers. The vaccine has been recommended for children since 1999, so children who have already been vaccinated should be protected. The recall products sold at Aldi include Season's Choice Raspberries and Season's Choice Berry Medley, both frozen. Raley's Fresh Frozen Red Raspberries, sold at Raley's supermarkets, were also recalled, but were not sold in San Diego County.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health alert. Over 2 million pounds of chicken products sold to institutions in 8 states, including California, have been recalled by Simmons Prepared Foods due to metal contamination. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Safety and Inspection Service announced the voluntary recall as a Class 1 recall, meaning there's a high health hazard risk with reasonable probability that using these products will cause serious adverse health consequences or even death, although no injuries have been reported so far. The poultry items were produced from October 21st through November 4th. They ranged from ready-to-cook chicken breasts, legs, and wings to halal chicken products. The problem was discovered by Simmons during processing. Anyone concerned about an injury or illness after eating these products should contact a health care provider. Federal regulators are concerned that some products may be frozen in institutional freezers. Institutions or anyone with these products is urged not to serve them. They should be thrown away or returned to the place of purchase.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. Energy microgrids, which can power businesses, neighborhoods, or even entire cities, are being touted as alternative ways to keep the lights on when California's big utility companies shut power to avert wildfires, CalMatters reports. Over 1 million Californians were left in the dark for days recently as big utility companies shut off power for fear of sparking wildfires. Frustrated by those outages, some homeowners are seeking alternatives to keep the lights on. The mayors of San Francisco and San Jose say they want to sever ties with Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E, which serves much of Northern California, and create separate utilities for their cities. Searching for solutions, one idea is to join microgrids, or set up banks of generators to keep electricity flowing during widespread power cutoffs. A microgrid can be as simple as a single home operating on its own solar power or a complex series of connections between a power source and distribution lines to end users. It can run a business, a neighborhood, or an entire city. It can be any size and may be fueled by either renewable energy stored in batteries or by generators run on a conventional fuel such as diesel. Borrego Springs is a local example of a city with a microgrid that powers the desert community. That town and others like it are known as end-of-the-line communities lying just beyond the reach of power companies' distribution lines. For those small locales and for residents in many rural parts of California, a microgrid is the only choice if they want power. Many state universities have training wheel versions that use small solar arrays to power a building or part of a campus. UC San Diego runs a much larger system that provides up to 90% of campus electricity. If some California lawmakers have their way, there will soon be many more such systems. A bill in the legislature would require utility companies to identify the state's best areas for microgrids and then build them. A 2018 law sets a deadline of December 1, 2020, just a year away, to create a program to operate microgrids, especially during emergencies. The State Public Utilities Commission, the California Energy Commission, and the Independent System Operator, which runs most of the state's electrical grid, are developing the plan. Former Governor Jerry Brown is an enthusiastic supporter of microgrids. He said in his 2015 inaugural address that they should be greatly expanded. His rural retirement compound, Rancho Venada, at the end of a dusty road in Colusa County, is powered by a microgrid system. Natural disasters have a way of prying open windows of opportunity, but California is behind the curve. Could the fires be our Superstorm Sandy, bringing about change? Hurricane Sandy lashed the East Coast in 2012, leaving millions of customers in 21 states without power for days or even weeks. The superstorm brought about policy changes in several Northeast states. Connecticut became first in the U.S. to create a statewide system of microgrids to provide emergency power. A microgrid research project at a Japanese university kept operating after a magnitude 9.1 earthquake, and a tsunami devastated Japan in 2011, knocking out power. That woke up policymakers. The genie was out of the bottle, so to speak. In the last few years, resilience has become the watchword for the advantages of microgrids. During the 2017 fires in Sonoma County, Stone Edge Farm drew electricity from its microgrids for 10 days while power was down from utilities. State officials hope that eventually electricity generated by microgrids can keep critical services operating during emergencies at hospitals, communication systems, community centers, and more. Fremont, California, has already outfitted 3 fire stations of its own with power supplies. Besides microgrids, many homeowners and small businesses use their own generators powered by diesel fuel, natural gas, or propane during outages. They work well, but have limitations. Diesel motors can be loud, and they can't be operated indoors because of dangerous fumes. Fuel for generators must be stored nearby, and that fuel is highly flammable, and usually based on fossil fuels. Many residential solar systems now include batteries to store energy from rooftop panels. During a blackout, these systems allow homeowners to just flip a switch and use their own stored power to keep the lights on. If used sparingly, running only critical appliances and devices, such storage systems can provide 5 or 10 hours of power. The batteries can replenish themselves during the day, so homeowners may be protected even in a prolonged outage. The systems are popular, as are solar-powered generators, all being heavily marketed as fires burn across the state. Susanna Churchill, the CEO of California Vote Solar, says people can power their refrigerators or computers, providing resilience during extended power outages. She adds that these systems can be critical for people who are dependent on electricity to operate at-home medical equipment, saving lives. A poke in the eye to big companies and their power cutoffs may provide momentary satisfaction and give customers some sense of control, but it won't solve the blackout problem long term. Most of us, after all, are connected to the grid and to the big utilities that have spent 100 years building it. The rise of small, locally run utilities known as community choice provides alternatives to big, for-profit utilities. Most of these entities use power that comes from clean energy. Many cities and counties have already gone this route, supplying power to 2.5 million customers in California last year. San Diego County and several local cities, including La Mesa in East County, have recently voted to adopt community choice programs. But even community choice programs rely on infrastructure owned by the big utilities, since they're plugged into the utilities' wires and poles. When PG&E recently shut off power to residents in Sonoma County for fear its equipment could start a fire, Sonoma Clean Power, a community choice utility, was unable to provide power, leaving its customers in the dark. At least one community choice utility, however, Peninsula Clean Energy up in San Mateo County, recently announced a $10 million investment in emergency backup power systems to keep electricity flowing to its customers even when PG&E shuts off power. CEO Jan Pepper told Californians Aware, Peninsula Clean Energy is concerned about residents for whom power shutoffs could be life-threatening, for example, those who rely on respirators. The idea is to keep them in their homes where they are comfortable with clean battery backup that can keep their essential medical equipment functioning. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Immigrants' rights groups are working to calm fears in the migrant community after a judge blocked President Donald Trump's changes to the public charge rules earlier this month. Those rules would have made it harder for people to get a green card or visa if they used programs such as Medi-Cal, CalFresh, or housing vouchers. Attorney Russell Haraghi with the nonprofit San Bernardino Community Service Center says some migrant parents are pulling their U.S. citizen children out of these programs for fear that it would hurt the parents' application for permanent residency later on.
These benefits that are available for your U.S. citizen kids are not going to hurt you. Even the proposed rule was clear that benefits for U.S. citizen kids would not penalize applicants.
Even if the Trump administration eventually prevails and gets a judge to greenlight the new rules, they wouldn't go into effect until all appeals are exhausted. And even then, immigration officials could only consider benefits used after the rule takes effect. It would not be retroactive. Supporters of the proposed changes say new immigrants should have to prove they can support themselves financially and will not rely on public benefits. Haraghi says the proposed changes have not been blocked for people who are applying for a green card from abroad or who were sent back to their home country to finish the application process.
Some people have to leave the United States to finish their process. Then a different set of rules apply. So those people, they should really talk to a lawyer before they pursue their applications.
The proposed changes also do not apply to people who already are permanent residents applying for citizenship or who are applying for asylum or refugee status. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news across our border region.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Rebecca Williamson with the People Power Report. Laura Elliott and Russell Haight work in a fly-in emergency room run by Mercy Air, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary as an air ambulance provider working out of Gillespie Field in El Cajon and other locations in California, Nevada, and Arizona. Flying in stormy weather and dodging power lines while landing on rough terrain are all just a part of the job. Elliot, the local base lead and flight paramedic, said in an interview with East County Magazine, "We've landed in intersections, cul-de-sacs, trails, and even a boat launch area at Barrett Lake. They've helped rescue patients during wildfires and other natural disasters. Last July, Mercy Air helped transfer patients out of a hospital damaged by the 7.1 Ridgecrest earthquake. Pilot Brent Bass airlifted a first responder out of a wildfire area. The team has even helped deliver babies. Last time we delivered a baby in a car was in Chula Vista at a high school," Elliot said. "Timely rescues are crucial in saving lives. The air ambulance acts as a link for survival, offering advanced trauma care to specialty care, such as stroke or cardiac specialties." According to staff, Mercy Air is the only air ambulance provider in Southern California equipped and trained to independently transport cardiac patients on an intra-aortic balloon pump. Russell Haight, a registered nurse, says the helicopter flies through rain or shine, and the pilot checks weather and conditions before taking off. Elliot and Haight, along with the pilot, deal in life or death situations on a 24/7, 365 days a year basis. The helicopter is equipped with medical apparatus to fit all ages and sizes, as well as medicines and more. The team is also prepared to honor all religious beliefs and customs if a patient passes away, and always protects patients' privacy. Mercy Air was established in 1989 and later merged with other programs such as Life Flight San Diego. Since then, the company has expanded to a fleet of 23 helicopters and one fixed-wing aircraft, helping to save countless lives.
Record numbers of Californians are now registered to vote, more than 20.3 million people, which is 3 million more than at this point in 2016, according to the latest statistics from the Secretary of State, Alex Padilla. More than 80% of voters in the Golden State have registered, which is the highest percentage in 67 years. Padilla says we're now 10 percentage points higher than the 2016 presidential election, and he predicts sky-high turnout for the 2020 presidential contest thanks to a number of state-level reforms.
Automatic voter registration and online registration have empowered millions of citizens to register to vote.
The state will also be mailing ballots to all voters next year. Voters can check that their registration is up to date at voterstatus.sos.ca.gov, and first-time voters can go to registertovote.ca.gov. People can also register to vote on Election Day itself at any polling place or early vote center. California's primary is set for March 3rd. Padilla notes that people registered with any of the political parties can only vote in that party's primary.
No party preference voters can, however, request to vote in the Democratic Party, Libertarian Party, or American Independent Party's presidential primary.
Democrats make up the largest block of registered voters in California, followed by no party preference, with Republicans coming in third. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week.
This week's Destination East County features a fall festival in Casa de Oro, a cultural arts expo in El Cajon, and a multicultural diversity event in Lemon Grove.
Plus, we have a preview of coming events, including concerts at the Magnolia Center, the Mother Goose Parade in El Cajon, a Thanksgiving feast at Pine Hills Lodge in Julian, Pomegranate Days at the Oasis Camel Dairy in Ramona, a Julian Country Christmas, Lakeside Spirit of Christmas on Main, Ramona's Christmas Tree Lighting, Santa at Santee Lakes, and La Mesa's Holiday in the Village.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
You're invited to discover local and international artists at the Cultural Art Expo on Saturday, November 9th from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. at the Marriott in downtown El Cajon. Guests can enjoy live music by the Jazzilla Band, a local Latin jazz legend, savor food samples from 12 to 2, visit a wine and beer garden, meet artists, and participate in art workshops. You can stop by East County Magazine's booth at the Cultural Art Expo to meet local authors who will be signing copies of their books. For tickets and details, you can visit artexpo@themarriott.com.
The Lemon Grove Multicultural Diversity event will provide an opportunity for residents to connect with each other through music, dance, and art, and to share their diverse perspectives, cultures, and values in a space where all can be accepted, appreciated, and celebrated. This event will be held on November 9th from 2 to 5 p.m. in Promenade Park, that's 3240 Main Street, in Lemon Grove. This event is organized by Thrive Lemon Grove.
The nonprofit Casa de Oro Alliance invites you to its fourth annual Fall Festival on Saturday, November 9th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. The event will be held at the Spring Valley Academy, 3900 Conrad Drive in Spring Valley. This free festive event has games, food trucks, entertainment, and prizes. For more information, visit CasaDeOroAlliance.org or check the Casa de Oro Alliance on Facebook.
The Mother Goose Parade has been delighting children and families for 73 years. This year, the parade will roll out through downtown El Cajon on Sunday, November 24th, starting at 1 p.m. The parade features an array of floats, marching bands, equestrians, clowns, local celebrities, and Santa Claus to welcome in the start of the holiday season. You can find the route and details at mothergooseparade.org.
The Magnolia Center, formerly known as the East County Performing Arts Center, has a variety of entertainment planned in November and early December. Concerts coming up include salsa artist Willie Colon, The World of Dance Live, the Danish heavy metal band King Diamond, and a 50-year-old tribute to the Beatles' White Album. For tickets and the full lineup, visit MagnoliaSanDiego.com or The Magnolia on Facebook.
The historic Pine Hills Lodge in Julian will be serving up a 10-course feast on Thanksgiving Day, November 28th. The lodge was built in 1912 as a romantic mountain hideaway by Colonel Ed Fletcher, a prominent San Diego developer and banker, and designed by world-famous architect Richard Requa, known for many of the structures in Balboa Park. The bark-on-wood log construction is considered irreplaceable. In 1925, the lodge sold to the operator of the Sutherland Stage and Yellow Cab, who built a gym at the lodge and invited his friend, boxer Jack Dempsey, to come train there. Cabins and tree houses were built in the 1920s through the 40s to accommodate more guests. The tree houses are gone, but the cabins still remain. The old gym became a movie theater and then a dinner theater, which closed in 2004. In 1998, the lodge underwent major renovations, and in 2003, it was acquired by new owners who aimed to rekindle a reputation for service in hospitality at Pine Hills Lodge, where you may even see some wild turkeys in the woods. Reservations are required for the Thanksgiving Fest at Pine Hills Lodge. Several seatings are available at 11 a.m., 1:30, and 4 p.m. To feast your eyes on the menu and make reservations, you can visit pinehillslodge.com.
The Oasis Camel Dairy in Ramona continues its annual Thanksgiving season tradition with Pomegranate Days, a three-day weekend, November 29th through December 1st. Guests can enjoy feeding pomegranates to friendly camels, camel rides and games for kids, a Wild West turkey stampede with the farm's famous pardoned turkeys, foods and circus acts by the Russell Brothers family, including juggling, magic, and more. For reservations and more information, you can visit CamelDairy.com and click on the Events tab.
Julian Country Christmas will be held on November 30th from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m., with lighting of the town's huge living Christmas tree and the arrival of Santa Claus between 5:30 and 6 p.m. at Pioneer Park in front of the Julian Pioneer Museum, 2711 Washington Street, Julian. Visitors can also enjoy shopping at boutique shops and craft stores for one-of-a-kind gifts at this annual event hosted by the Julian Chamber of Commerce. You can find details on this event in Julian and more at visitjulian.com in the calendar section.
The Lakeside Chamber of Commerce invites you to celebrate at its 21st annual Spirit of Christmas on Main Avenue on Saturday, December 7th from 3:30 to 8:30 p.m. Santa and his elves are hard at work creating an atmosphere of an old-fashioned hometown Christmas featuring local school performances of holiday favorites, photos with Santa, food and drinks, children's activities, jumpy jumps, crafters booths, and lighting of the community Christmas tree. Find details at lakesidechamber.com.
The Ramona Chamber of Commerce hosts the 27th annual Christmas tree lighting on Saturday, December 7th from 5 to 8 p.m. Old Town Ramona will come alive with over 1,000 Ramona residents out to celebrate the holiday season. Shops will be open late, and Main Street between 6th and 8th Streets will be closed to traffic. There will be sleigh rides, a classic car and motorcycle display, music, dancing, carolers, and of course Santa. The lighting of the tree in front of the Guy B. Woodward Museum will take place at 6 p.m. For more information, visit RamonaChamber.com.
Santee Lakes invites you to join Santa at the lakes on Sunday, December 8th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. The festivities will feature a snow hill, carnival rides, inflatable jumps, crafts, food, character meets and greets, and Santa Claus. Get more information at SanteeLakes.com.
The La Mesa Village Association's Holiday in the Village returns to downtown La Mesa December 13th and 14th. This family-friendly event will feature a wonderland of festive holiday music and dance, food, kids' activities, live entertainment, merchants open late for holiday shopping, and more. Watch for details at LaMesaVillageAssociation.org.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more in the calendar and events section at our website, EastCountyMagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back soon with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment.
Today I'm interviewing Don Harrison, author of Schlepping Through the American West, There's a Jewish Story Everywhere. My guest, a seasoned journalist, is also editor and publisher of San Diego Jewish World, an online newspaper that serves the San Diego Jewish community and serves Jews around the world. So welcome, Don. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Raina, for having me.
Let's start with your history. I know that since 1986, you've been writing Jewish stories about events, people, and places not only in San Diego, but in the rest of the country and the world. How did you get started writing Jewish stories?
Well, I had been a journalist before. I had been the political writer for the San Diego Union. And then I got into public relations and found myself missing journalism. About the same time, my daughter, Sandy, had her bat mitzvah. And I had come from a family that wasn't all that involved with the Jewish community, and I never had a bar mitzvah as a kid. And they have a ceremony where they pass down the Torah from generation to generation. And as I watched it go briefly into my arms and then to her arms, I thought, wow, she's inherited a heritage that I don't have. I want to learn more about this. And I thought, well, I'm a reporter, I'm a journalist. The best way I can learn is if I start writing stories about the Jewish community. And I volunteered to write stories for one of the Jewish newspapers, the San Diego Jewish Press Heritage, which ultimately I became the editor-in-chief and later the publisher of.
And do you remember your first Jewish story?
Yes. Actually, it was a trialogue among three rabbis from the different movements. One was a rabbi from the Orthodox Beth Jacob. His name was Rabbi Langer. The other one was a rabbi from the conservative Tiferet Israel, and that was Aaron Gold. And the third one was from the Reform Congregation Temple Emmanuel, and that was Rabbi Marty Lawson. And they held forth about the differences among the movements, and it ran as a front-page story, not in the Heritage. This was before I started with the Heritage. It was in the competitive paper, which was then called, I think, San Diego Israel Today or something like that.
Okay, so you fell in love with writing those stories.
Yeah, it was great. It really was. And ever since, I've always looked for Jewish angles to stories. And as a regional newspaper might ask for what's the El Cajon angle or the East County angle, I ask what's the Jewish angle.
Well, in Schlepping Through the American West, you and your grandson go on a 3,600-mile round-trip odyssey from San Diego to Alberta, Canada, discovering Jewish stories and links. How did that trip get started, and why the American West?
Well, I think it's kind of fascinating that here in San Diego, we have two northbound interstate freeways that actually cross, I-5, which goes north along the coast, and I-15. And I thought, well, that makes for an interesting route, wouldn't it, if you were to go up the I-15 all the way to Canada and then perhaps across and then come down to the 5 and end up at the same place. And I don't know why I became fixated on that, but I thought, gee, that would be a fun trip. And I asked Shore if he would like to go with me and see what we could find. And Shore's my grandson, and he said yes.
So when you took this trip, did you have it preset where you'd go or how you would dig up these stories, or was that spontaneous?
Well, it was a little of each. In some cases, we actually wrote ahead and knew that we wanted to go there and hoped that we could arrange interviews. In other places, it was just serendipitous. For example, one story I wrote was at an Indian reservation, the Blackfoot Indian Reservation, and we went into a trading post. I happened to pick up a book there that was written by one of the members of the Blackfoot Indians, and found it so fascinating that I decided to devote a column or a story to that.
And you found a Jewish angle for that.
Well, the Jewish angle was the comparison, because they believe that, for example, mice can talk. They don't necessarily believe, but in their legends, the mice talk. And they also have ceremonies where they have their tobacco pipe and they wave it in the directions of the four directions and up and down.
Uh-huh.
And I found similarities to Judaism in that. We have in Judaism in the Torah, the story of a donkey who was carrying a passenger and is stopped by an angel of the Lord and won't move. And the fellow riding him starts whacking him. And the donkey looks up and says, "Why are you hitting me? You know, haven't I always been good?" And so it's not all that amazing to have a story about a talking animal in a religious text. And similarly, we have a ceremony in Judaism where we wave our lulavs during the holiday of Sukkot and to the different directions. So it was a nice place to find a comparison.
Interesting. So the book is both a guidebook and it's a collection of tales. Could you share with us right now a little bit of your favorite tale?
Well, I don't know if it's my favorite.
What are your favorites?
One of my favorite. But one of the places that we went to was in Idaho. Remember, we're going along the Interstate 15, and we found out that the town of Blackfoot, Idaho, had the Potato Museum.
Okay.
And we thought, gee, what? That would be interesting, the Potato Museum. So I'll start a little bit of it. About the time that movie star Marilyn Monroe converted to Judaism in association with her marriage to playwright Arthur Miller, potato farmers and marketers in Idaho were talking about how beautiful a woman she was. Quote, "She's the kind of woman who would look good in anything, even a potato sack," said one. "Say, that's a brilliant idea," said another. "Let's see if we can get her to pose for our advertising campaign." They did, and she did, producing a memorable image of Monroe in a burlap bag. As was clear to everyone, she was outstanding in her field. The joke there being that she's standing in a potato field.
Oh,
the Monroe,
I didn't even get that. I got it now. Thank you.
The Monroe image is just one of the exhibits of the Idaho Potato Museum, which shares crowded quarters in a former railroad depot with the Blackfoot Chamber of Commerce. Here one can learn about the history of the Idaho potatoes, as well as about some of the innovations that have changed the way potatoes are planted and harvested. There are also interesting potato-based collections, such as postage stamps from around the world, featuring potatoes or their lore, an assemblage of Mr. Potato Head toys, and a one-of-a-kind souvenir, a potato signed by former U.S. Vice President Dan Quayle.
Oh, wonderful. It was really fun to read.
Do you remember Dan Quayle and his famous potato gaffe, and he wanted to put an extra E on it?
Yes.
So that's why they got him to sign the potato, and he was a good enough sport to do it.
Great. I know that one of your readers, Rabbi Ben Kamen, he called you not only the ultimate wandering Jew, but he said you're a highly valued wondering Jew. What other topics besides the themes that you've mentioned, potatoes and history, what other topics do you wonder about in Schlepping Through the American West? What topics do you think are relevant to everyone, no matter what their faith is?
Well, I think most of them are. There were perhaps one or two stories that you might say were almost exclusively Jewish. I dealt with a synagogue, a Jewish synagogue, obviously, and a Jewish cemetery in two different chapters. But the rest of them really were about Americana. Mm-hmm. And I look at these stories as tapestries, and through these tapestries, there might be a Jewish thread here and there. I try to focus on the Jewish thread, but as well to tell the story of the place. So, for example, we went to the buffalo preserve up in Montana, the bison preserve, I should say properly, because mm-hmm. they aren't really buffaloes, and talked about how Theodore Roosevelt was involved in the conservation of these incredible creatures who were slaughtered, unfortunately, during the 19th century and who mm-hmm. faced extinction, and told about what the experience is like to drive through the National Bison Range and to see these creatures and have them come right up to your car. And at the same time, wove through it the interesting fact, at least to me, that Moise, M-O-I-E-S-E, is the name of the town that the National Bison Range is in. And of course, I drew the conclusion that Moise was a biblical name or from Moses. Mm-hmm. And found out that it was actually the name of the Native American who owned the area and who had been given his name by a church. And so my conclusion actually worked out that there was this Jewish thread running through it. And I talked about Theodore Roosevelt and Moses both being conservationists. And there's mm-hmm. a famous Jewish story, we call a Midrashim, about Moses who had a sheep that wandered away from the flock, and he followed the sheep, and he found the sheep drinking from the water, and he realized that the reason that the sheep had left was because he was so thirsty, and he felt sorry for the sheep. And so when he retrieved him, instead of being angry at him, he put him on his shoulders and he carried him back to the flock. And according to the story, God saw this, and he says if he treats the sheep so well, he'll also treat the Israelites well, mm-hmm. and he'll be the leader. And so these kinds of stories, you try to weave together as you go to places that are of general sightseeing interest.
It really does sound like a tapestry.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to the global stage for a moment. I know a very hot topic. In any way, does all the unrest and violence in the Middle East affect your writing, your perspective, anything that you're doing?
It's an interesting question. When I say in the subtitle of the book that there's a Jewish story everywhere, I have, you might say, three reasons why I'm able to say that. Israel is one. I mean, everybody in the world, every country in the world, either has relations or refuses to have relations with Israel. And so that offers one, you might say, possible range of stories. Mm-hmm. And the other two kinds of stories is the Bible, which I've just mentioned. The Hebrew scriptures are known throughout the world and so forth. And the third thing is that Jews have been a very peripatetic people. We traveled everywhere to a large degree because we were merchants and we would open up new trade routes and open up stores and so forth. And so you can always find from those three themes, some sort of a story. And occasionally the story may well be about Israel. In fact, let's see, I guess it's in Rancho San Diego or El Cajon, I guess, is this big skyline church. And if you go there, I mean, they're very Israel oriented. They have a wall inside their atrium that looks like the Kotel, the Wailing Wall or the mm-hmm. Western Wall of Jerusalem, where parishioners can stick notes into it. And they have two big pillars in that atrium that are supposed to be the pillars of Solomon. And it's an example of how important those scriptures are, not only to Jews, but to the Western religions.
Wonderful. You really have a lot to show us that's already been there, and we haven't looked at it quite that way. How about East County? Are there any stories that particularly focus in East County that you'd like to share with us?
Well, just briefly, there are some that I've always enjoyed. In La Mesa, for example, one of the landmarks there is Mount Nebo. And, of course, in the Bible, Mount Nebo was the place where Moses looked out over the promised land and then died, and he wasn't allowed to actually go to the promised land. I always wondered about that name, like, mm-hmm. gee, you get to look out, but you don't get to come down the mountain. But I guess the developers were thinking about the other Israelites who would actually go into the promised land and had a great view of it.
So Lemais is the promised land.
Well, they were, as far as the developers, there was a fellow named Sherman Grable, who was a Methodist, and he used that metaphor. In Santee, at the Santee Lakes, it's one of my favorite places to go walking, and I draw inspiration from the way the different species get along. I have pictures of pelicans and cormorants sharing the same rock, and pictures of egrets and herons fishing from the same shore, and an osprey and another egret up in the same tree. And so you get this sort of sense of a multiculturalism at the Santee Lakes. And yet at the same time, you also see flocks of ducks together, of mud hens together. And so they have their separate cultures, but they also mingle together. And I think of that as a metaphor.
Yeah, I love that metaphor.
And then finally in Lakeside, the old Lakeside hotel was at one point owned by, the whole rancho was owned by Adolph Levi, who was a fellow in Julian, who, if you ever go to the Julian drugstore, there's a plaque on the drugstore that it was once owned by him. But he also purchased land, and so that area was owned by the Levi family. And so it's just another strand that runs through these tapestries.
Great. Thanks for sharing those.
Sure.
Interesting. One last question. What are you writing next? Will it be more travels from a Jewish American grandfather, or will it be something entirely different?
Well, I have another book that I'm collating now. It's called Schlepping Over the High Seas.
Okay, and more schlepping.
I've done a lot of cruising, and just as I have done in the American West, whenever I get to a port, I try to find the Jewish story. And of course, there are many Jewish stories, on the ships. And so these are tapestries. They are stories about cruising, about the kinds of people you might meet on a cruise ship, about, places you might go or the cruise ship might take you. But I always try to find that little Jewish thread within those stories.
And when do you think it'll be available?
Well, I'm guessing sometime next year. It's a matter now of pulling stories from, I've been a journalist for over 50 years, and I'm trying to go back and to find some of those stories that meet the theme. And that takes a little while, and maybe I'll go on a cruise or two between now and then.
Oh, you'll have to go on a cruise. Well, we look forward to seeing it. Our time is up, Don, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I greatly enjoyed the interview.
For more information on Don Harrison and his work, please visit sdjewishworld.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
When most of us think about Thanksgiving, images of turkey, stuffing, and time spent with loved ones typically comes to mind, not fire hazards. However, an increased risk of fire is, in fact, a reality of Thanksgiving, reminds Fire Chief Sam DiGiovanna. According to the National Fire Protection Association, 3 times as many home-cooked fires occur on Thanksgiving as on a typical day. Unattended cooking is the leading cause of home-cooking fires. So here are the National Fire Protection Association's top 5 tips for cooking with fire safety in mind on Thanksgiving and beyond. Stay in the kitchen while you're cooking and keep a close eye on what you fry. Always stay in the kitchen while frying, grilling, or broiling food. If you do have to leave the kitchen for even a short period of time, turn off the stove. Regularly check on food that's simmering, baking, or roasting, and use a timer to remind you when it's done. Keep things that can catch fire, such as oven mitts, wooden utensils, food packaging, towels, and curtains, away from your cooking area. Be alert when cooking. If you're asleep, don't use the stove or the stovetop. If you do have a small grease cooking fire on the stovetop and decide to fight the fire, smother the flames by sliding a lid over the pan and turning off the burner. Leave the pan covered until it is completely cooled. For an oven fire, turn off the heat and keep the door closed. If you're cooking a turkey using a disposable aluminum pan, consider doubling up and using 2 pans to avoid a puncture, since dripping turkey juices, while delicious, can also cause an oven fire. Stay safe and have a happy Thanksgiving.
Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
For the second year in a row, the percentage of uninsured kids has stagnated in the Golden State and is going up nationwide, according to a new report. Researchers from the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families found that 3.1% of California's kids, about 300,000 children, have no health insurance. Myra Alvarez with the Children's Partnership says we should be doing better considering the state increased premium subsidies and extended Medi-Cal to everyone younger than 26, regardless of immigration status.
California has taken multiple proactive steps to expand coverage, but we aren't making a dent in the number of uninsured kids in California, despite the fact that the economy has been strong.
The report says the number of uninsured kids increased by 400,000 children nationwide between 2016 and 2018. The authors blame the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, as well as President Trump's anti-immigrant policies, which have led many parents to drop their kids from government programs. Joan Alker with the Georgetown Center says the loss of coverage hurt Latino children the most, but several other groups also saw decreases in coverage.
White children also had a significant loss of coverage, young children under age 6, and that's really troubling. And we're also seeing families who are just right above the poverty lines with incomes around $30,000 a year, those working poor families losing coverage.
Nationwide, the rate of uninsured kids went from 4.7% in 2016 to 5.2% in 2018, leaving a total of 4 million American children uninsured. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
On behalf of East County Magazine, we salute our veterans this Veterans Day weekend. We also have some special events to announce for military vets and their families. County Parks and Recreation invites veterans and civilians on a warrior hike Saturday, November 9th in El Capitan County Preserve in Lakeside. There are several ability levels with boot camp and recon. Those are moderate 1- and 3-hour hikes, a 12-mile warrior hike, and a special ops hike rated extremely difficult. The hikes start around 7 a.m. with refreshment stations. However, hikers should bring plenty of water. At Lake Jennings in Lakeside, fishing fees are being waived for vets on Monday, November 11th for Veterans Day from 6 a.m. to 5 p.m., and the City of El Cajon will hold a ceremony honoring veterans on Monday from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. in Centennial Plaza in downtown El Cajon. The community is invited to come show respect and appreciation for those who have helped to keep our country safe.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show. This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine show here on KNSJ. I want to take a moment to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to hear our show, where we report news that matters to people across our region. In an era of cuts to many major media outlets, shrinking local news coverage, and cries of fake news attacking journalists with courage to report the truth, it's important to recognize and support KNSJ Radio. KNSJ gives airtime for original reporting on issues that matter here in San Diego and East County, as well as national news that impacts people here at home. You can donate to help support real news, honest reporting, and inclusion of your community's views and voices at knsj.org. That website again is knsj.org.